This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the March 11th edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm Mike Hogan, joined via Skype. Both of them are in Southern California, but not together. I think you guys are springing for separate hotel rooms, I'm guessing. Mr. Jonathan Kinchin and Mr. Peter Thomas Fornatel, welcome, gentlemen.
Morning.
What's going on? It's great to be out here in SoCal. Had a wonderful day in paradise yesterday in the Eddie Logan suite. Had a great time. I met a guy who I think Jonathan has met before who has a connection to the handicapping contest world, Marvin Kaminsky. Do you know Marvin?
Oh, do I know Marvin? Marvin is my idol. I think Marvin's one of the coolest men in the world. I got to meet Marvin at the NHC. I'll let you tell the story of who Marvin is, but Marvin is definitely infamous.
He's an associate of several professional gamblers, including the Matisse brothers, for whom he helps out in Vegas when it comes time to get bets down in certain places. Some might call him a runner, an actual Vegas runner. And he's just the nicest guy. It turns out he loves doo-wop music. So because of my dad, you know, I've got like a little bit of a background, more of a rock and roll guy myself, but I speak a little doo-wop. So we were having fun talking doo-wop, talking about the Matisse boys, and basically just talking about how the Eddie Logan suite is one of the most amazing places in the world. I think I twisted his arm to come back today, so hopefully we'll get a chance to hang out. But I don't want to bury the lead here too much on today's show. Jonathan, since the last time you appeared on this program, you have broken out of your slump, as it were, in a big way. You went and won every contest there was to win on the DRF family last weekend. NHC qualified, BC qualified, DRF qualified. Kinchin's name was at the top of every one of them. What got into you last weekend?
Actually, it was like one of those unfortunate situations. My father had surgery, so I was stuck hanging out in the hospital with him. And I had nothing to do but peruse through the PPs, and I got to really kind of hone in. And like you said, kind of in the piece that you wrote, leading up to the NHC, I put a lot of effort and energy into being as prepared as I possibly could. And after about like the first 2 hours, it didn't really work out. And so it's been hard for me to kind of get back going into that intense groove of mine since then, just based on the disappointment. And I was thrust into a situation where I was allowed to do that, so it paid off.
How's your dad's health doing?
Oh, he's good. He'll be fine.
Good.
He's good to go.
Good.
Yeah.
I've actually got a theory about this, Jonathan.
Okay.
my theory is you're like Biff from Back to the Future, but much nicer. You've got a copy from the future of a racing manual. And the thing is, you're being smart about it, because if you won everything, people would be like, hey, wait, what's going on here? So you just pick the right times to say, okay, this week, going to do it. Not going to win the first NHC. I'll do a nice run. I'll throw them off in the second one because I'm the favorite and everybody's expecting it. You're doing it really well. You're doing it really well.
I saw another Back to the Future tweet this week, which is making me a little uncomfortable about this comparison. But someone said that I think Craig Burnick actually from Glen Hill Farm tweeted that Back to the Future is coming to reality and Biff is Donald Trump.
Oh,
yeah. Something. Oh my gosh! No,
wow.
it was fortunate. I had a good weekend. You know, you gotta have a lot of things go your way when you have good weekends like that. And I had a 35-1 shot that I thought, you know, and I watch a lot of racing, and I thought I was beat in the photo, and he won, and that, you know, that happened to make the difference. So, I tell you what, it was fun. I forgot what it felt like to have a lot of success like that. It's been a while. It feels like it's been a while.
Well, I know that Paul Sherman was a little upset with you over the weekend, Jonathan. Do you know this story?
I think I know the story. I'll let you tell it.
He was playing on another contest site and saw that going into the last race, you had like three entries in the top 10, and none of those, when the long shot won, none of those three entries ended up doing anything. And he was playing in that contest, and he texted you something along the lines of, oh man, I'm sorry about your tough beat, and you just said something along the lines of, yeah, it would have been good. I was hoping to win that contest too. And then he was unaware of the fact that you won every other contest that day, and he's like, "What? I thought I liked Jonathan, but what a jerk! He let me give him sympathy on a day when he won the whole universe in the DRF."
Yeah, he texted me. He said, "I was feeling bad for you," and then I found out later that you won like three other seats, and I don't feel bad for you anymore. So yeah, it was rough.
Pretty funny stuff.
All right. Well, nice weekend, Jonathan. Let's hope you can keep it going this weekend and give out some nice picks and insight on the podcast today, because we got a lot of good races to cover. And before we do that, though, let's red board a derby, okay?
Like it.
You guys up for it? We're going to do the 2010 Kentucky Derby. As we know, because I'm sure your racing manual from the future has the 2010 results as well, so you know that the winner was Super Saver, and paid $18. However, without knowing and looking at the PPs fresh, let's talk about how you'd handicap this race and how you see the race. You know, I mean, this is recent enough that you can even talk about the way you played it. Jonathan, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. This was one of my prime examples of why I try not to fall in love with horses on the Derby Trail at this time of the year. I almost try to ignore the Derby Trail. I mean, I participate in the Derby Trail. I'm looking, but I try to, because I fall in love with horses. It's happened to me in the past, and this is one of the first times it ever happened to me with Sydney's Candy. I was in love. I loved Sydney's Candy, and looking back at it now as I think a much more mature handicapper, it's, you know, the horse went 112 and change, 113 and change, twice in a row going two turns on the lead with an easy lead. And that's just a complete bet against. And I'm disappointed in myself for not catching that as a younger handicapper. But looking through this race, I noticed two things. One thing I can't get out of my mind, and unfortunately that's the advantage of playing red – or I'm sorry, fortunately that's the advantage of red boarding is I remember how lights out Patio Prado was working. And I think that it's very important. This is the first time that I really latched onto a horse that was getting a lot of buzz from Mike Welsh and the guys that do the clocking at Churchill Downs the week of. And it's a reminder to me to remind you.
Uh-oh. I think we lost Jonathan. All right. Well, we'll keep going. We'll keep moving forward with it. We'll get Jonathan and Pete back. But yeah, so I will jump in with my analysis. It's funny, Jonathan was mentioning Patio Prado prior to the race. I looked at this race as a lot of turf horses trying to run on dirt, and especially back at the time when we had a lot of synthetic surfaces, both in Southern California and, of course, at Turfway Park and at Keeneland as well. You had a lot of turf horses, you had a lot of synthetic horses, and very few dirt horses, and I think the defection late from the race of Escondrea, the winner of the Wood Memorial, likely would have been the favorite in here had he gone, made the race much, much, much more wide open. And I was frankly against a horse like Sydney's Candy for a couple of reasons. Jonathan mentioned him as being loose on the lead a couple times, set slow fractions. Last time in the Santa Anita Derby coming into the race, he was really aided by a rather rough trip from looking at Lucky, who in my estimation was the best horse in the field, but drew absolutely horribly by drawing the rail here. Sydney's Candy drew out to the outside. He was likely facing a lot of other early speed in here. I did not see him getting the kind of setup that he got in either the San Felipe or the San Vicente or the Santa Anita Derby. So I was way against a horse like Sydney's Candy from the outside post facing a lot of other speed. The horse that I wanted to bet, looking at Lucky, I just could not take it a short price on the rail. And if you ever want to see a reason for that, watch the replay of the 2010 Kentucky Derby. Focus on looking at Lucky's trip from that one post. The worst trip you will ever see a horse get. And even in finishing sixth in that race, he may very well have been by far the best horse in the race just to even get sixth with the kind of trip he had. Pete, we have you back.
Indeed. Yeah, I wasn't able to hear what you guys were talking about, but my story of this race was one about how I think handicapping the Kentucky Derby is so different than handicapping other races. When these PPs came out, do you still have me, Mike?
You're still there. Keep going.
Okay. Jonathan was disappeared on my screen for a second. I was worried you lost me again. When I first handicapped this race, I wish we had the morning lines. I believe that Super Saver was something like 8-1, maybe even higher on the line. And he, I thought, just from the basic principles of handicapping, looked like a solid paper choice. And when the odds opened, you got an idea, like sort of at the end of the day Friday, when they opened the Derby betting a day early, and seeing Super Saver, I think at that time at 5-1, I was in a real like value line betting mindset at that point. And I was like, well, I think this horse should be about 6-1. I was expecting to get 8-1, and he's 5-1. So I'm not going to bet this horse Derby. I think it's fair to say that he wasn't. But sometimes when you're a horse player, and everybody knows you're a horse player, and people ask you your Derby horse for weeks leading up to it, and some people talk about it like we do on this podcast, talk about the Kentucky Derby all winter. There's something more than money, I think, associated with being able to say I had the Derby winner. And this was a case for me where I think if I just kept it simple and maybe just used it, instead of getting all against using him in the top spot, either tried to get clever underneath or just said the heck with it, I'm going to make maybe a smaller bet using Super Saver on top, I'd be having a very positive story to tell about this Kentucky Derby instead of the reality, which is that I blew it completely and I ended up missing the race, even though I liked the horse who won, which is, something that can happen. And on a day-to-day basis, I have no problem with that. You can't – the only way – I heard somebody say this in a very smart way once that I'll try to repeat. The only way you can lose in horse racing in the long term is betting horses whose prices are shorter than they should be. And while that's true, I think, for the grind that is a day-to-day basis, I think a race like the Kentucky Derby is kind of special, and it's okay to take a little maybe more of a contest player's perspective and play who you like. So that's what I wish I had done in the Super Saver Kentucky Derby.
Well, and even in a race like the Derby, because there's so many horses entered, you're going to get a decent price on any of them. And in this case, your favorite in the off odds was looking at Lucky at odds of 6-1. So even if you wanted to bet the favorite, you were still getting a fair price.
I mean, it's all relative, right? I still don't think that for what I remember of looking at the race at the time, it just seemed like no horse should be that short.
Sure. And especially not from the rail.
It's stuck in my head,
Yeah.
It's stuck in my
head. I hear you. Well, Jonathan, while you dropped, I was talking about why I didn't like Sydney's Candy. Marooned out in the 20 post, loose leads the last few starts. I saw a lot more speed in here. I didn't think it set up well for him. I like looking at Lucky Best, but I just couldn't bet him on the rail at a short price. And I said that there were a lot of turf horses in here and synthetic horses that I didn't really think wanted the dirt. So, that kind of leaves you with a few horses. I think one of them was Jackson Bend, now not facing a horse like Escondrea, who he ran second to. Escondrea, let's face it, had he drawn well and had he gone here, probably would have been a pretty significant favorite in the Derby. And so Jackson Bend now not facing Escondrea. I think he obviously made a lot of sense on paper. Of course, later we learned he was maybe a little bit better sprinting, but you were getting a fair price at 23-1 on a horse like him. And I was also against the filly, Devil May Care. I was taking it from the standpoint of, look, in 2009 you had a filly who, if she had run, Rachel Alexandra had run in the Derby, she may very well have run or won the race. Devil May Care was coming off a huge buyer in the previous start in the Bonnie Mist, a 100, which was the co-top buyer. Sydney's Candy was the only other one to have 100. Let's also mention that. This is a year when you didn't have any other runners in the Derby with a buyer figure over 100. When we're talking about buyer figures and how low they are seemingly this year, it's not an anomaly. There have been many years like this in the past, 2010 being a very good example, where you had a lot of horses with the mid-90s buyers coming into the race. So off of that last start, I thought Devil May Care was going to be way over bet, and I thought a lot of people were going to be thinking, oh, sentimental filly, Rachel Alexandra, maybe she's good enough against a field of nondescript boys, and I was kind of against her. So that was sort of my approach in the race. Also looking for some other ones, like maybe Discreetly Mine, to get a good trip. But, you know, Super Saver, Discreetly Mine, Jackson Bend, those were kind of the ones that I was most likely to focus on in this race.
Right.
I was just asking, Mike, if you remembered how you played it.
You know, this was a race I didn't really play too much. I think I may have had a very small win bet on those three, but I really, it was a year I was less interested in the field, because I liked looking at Lucky Best, but then when he drew the rail, I was just like, there's no way I'm touching him. So kind of just backed off.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what point I was lost in, but did I make my Patio Prado point, or did I get lost when I was talking?
You started to. You said okay. he was the horse that was coming in off of the top works, and Mike Welsh was really high on him prior to the race.
Right. So that's one, you know, I learned a lesson from that race, and every year since then I've included some horse that was just clearly a horse that I didn't really love on paper, but I had heard such good things about how the horse was working into the race. And I think that's really important going into the Derby, especially going a mile and a quarter, just how the horses are doing. One of the biggest things from this Derby that I remember today and I remember then, was Icebox was just like the biggest play against. I mean, he got a huge setup that day on Florida Derby Day. And that's the kind of horse that, you know, I think a lot of people think that just because they're going long or they're going a mile and a quarter, that actually sets up better for closers. And I just think the opposite. I think that there's a lot more opportunities for trouble in a 20 horse field. They're at the mercy of the pace now, even more than ever, with not having sprinters in the Derby like they used to in the past because of the new points rules. It's even less likely that we're going to have the supersonic pace like we've seen in the past. We've seen that the last couple of years where it's been a little bit slower than expected. And so Icebox would be a play against today. He was a play against then. You got to look for those types of horses.
Yeah, I was completely with you.
He ran really well, but he galloped out terrible, as I recall. Well, didn't he ran second though, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah, no,
he did.
He had trouble. He had trouble that, and it was on his wrong lead, and if I can recall correctly, and ran really well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that made him, I think, ridiculously over bet next out in the Preakness, right?
Belmont.
He skipped the Preakness and went to the Belmont.
Yeah, and he was the favorite. And was my the first big score of my life. I was alive in the pick four that day, and I didn't have Icebox, and he was the favorite, and I was panicking with really, really, really big will pace.
And did you hedge?
No, you know I don't hedge, Pete.
I was hoping I could get you to say, you know, grab your something on the podcast. I was trying to trick you, but
I thought about it, but I thought I should keep it clean.
It's a family show. Yeah. Grab your grapefruits. We got to come up with some sort of acceptable humor.
That's what my old racetrack, my racetrack mentor, I called him and I said, Hoss, I don't have Icebox. And he told me, he said, did you like Icebox this morning when you woke up and when you bet it? I said, no. He goes, well, grab your grapefruits. And I said,
that's actually great advice, you know. And yeah. You know, it reminds me that we were in a situation when we were playing together in the fall when I was over in the UK, and we were playing one of the big California Breeders' Cup prep days, and it was one of those – it was the opposite situation. There was a horse in the last leg that we didn't include simply because of cost reasons, and that's a different answer then to me. Like, that horse, you're sitting 5-5 in a pick six – and you have a horse that you wanted to include but didn't, like, that's where it's okay to hedge. You can't start betting against yourself, you know, unless you can, to me, maybe if you could lock in an absolute profit and you're already looking at so much money, then maybe. But in real life, that situation doesn't come up very often. And that's a perfect example. Icebox was, to me, in that Belmont spot, a huge bet against, for the reasons you said, Jonathan, and the fact that, as I recall, he like galloped out like a horse that would need a couple months off. And so if you just start at that point, you're, I think the hedge, you're kind of betting scared. And, you know, we know what happens when you bet scared. You lose your money.
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's use that as a good transition to something that we got into, at least Pete and you and I got into a little discussion on Twitter amongst some other folks about approaching multi-race wagers and particularly using the all button, not just in one leg, which I think is fine at times, and I've certainly done at times, but multiple legs of a multi-race wager. There are some people that like to press the all button, you know, in some cases as extreme as all, single, all, hoping to catch bombs. Or in even maybe two legs of a multi-race wager, would either of you ever go all? Jonathan, you look like you're smelling something that doesn't smell too good.
No, I hate the all button. And I hate it for a lot of reasons. So, one, there's at least one horse that you don't like. So let's save the money. You know, and it adds up. If you're doing that every weekend and you keep hitting the all button, throw out at least one horse. Throw out two horses. Now, if you're saying that it's a chaos race and the race is just chaotic as ever and you like a single in another race, then take out the top three favorites and throw them out. And if they win, you don't want the ticket anyways, and then use all the prices. But, you know, just hitting the all button is – and I'm not trying to be ugly. I just think it's lazy, and I think it's – and I think it's hoping. And I don't think that when you bet, you should be betting with hope. You should be betting what you think is going to happen. And that's what I try to do. And I don't get me wrong. Have I hit the all button when I've had a few beverages and I'm running around and things are crazy? Like, yeah, but I don't do it as a serious play. It's never part of what I do.
So let me put words in your mouth for a second. It sounds like what you're saying is when you play the all button, you're maybe turning yourself in from a handicapper into more of a gambler.
Yeah, and I am that for sure. If you've ever seen me at the roulette table or the craps table, I am a gambler. So that's that other hat yeah. That I'm, you know, but I don't take it as a serious approach to a play on a big day or a big investment of a pick four, pick five, or pick six. I don't ever do it.
But when you're handicapping, your edge is the ability to handicap, say, better than the rest of the public. So therefore, by definition, the all button seems counterintuitive.
And you should feel that way. If you're putting your money through the window, you should feel that you're better than the public.
Yeah, that's fair. Pete, it looks like you wanted to chime in.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to. The point I made in this Twitter conversation is, to me, it's a rare occasion. But, and I mean, and Jonathan's point about using the all button minus the favorites in a chaos race is also worthy of consideration. But I will say, I've never done it in a pick four, but there have been times, select times in my life, where I might do a pick three using all in two legs. And it typically does have to do with my only opinion in that race is that favorites are weak, not weak enough that I want to leave them out entirely and bet against them. So what I might do, and when I say the all button, you might do all for a dollar. So you cover everything, you know, let's say your key horse is in leg A. So you go key, you know, key all. But then you also, to actually have it express your full opinion, if it's, you would bet another dollar maybe on your whoever those top value plays or contenders or whatever you want to call them in these races where you don't have the strongest opinion, you want to hit that combination an extra time and really try to get something out of it. So I think, you know, if favorites are bad and your opinion isn't that strong, I honestly don't have a problem with it, but I'm talking about a situation that, I mean, I think I've done it twice, like in memory. It doesn't come up all the time. If your default bet is all is key all, you should be making a lot more win bets.
I do think that, I think that all three of us would agree that we would plead with our watchers, that our listeners or whatever, that you, if you are in an opinion, a race where you feel like you need to hit the all button, just hop on a ticket maker. And if it's an eight-horse field, then at least take four of those horses and make them A horses and four of them and make them B horses and press the four a little bit harder than you're pressing the, you know, the A's and you're pressing the B's. I mean, that's at least a much more intelligent way to go about it. than just hitting the all button and spending the same amount of money on the 30-1 shot that has no chance versus the 5-2 shot Baffert dropper that you kind of want to be against, but the horse could win by 7. It just doesn't make sense to spend the same amount of money on those horses.
Yeah, Ticket Maker makes that very possible. And the great thing, I mean, I've seen people make snarky, imagine this, snarky comments in the DRF, in the DRF comment section about, I remember one time specifically, Mike Watchmaker gave out a very clever Ticket Maker pick 3 where I don't know that he used all. I think it was more like what Jonathan was saying, that maybe there was one race where there were 8 runners and he used 6 of them in different combinations as A's, B's, and C's. And somebody said like, oh, well, you're covering 80% of the horses in the sequence. What is this? Blah, blah. But good ticket writing with a program like Ticketmaker especially, you can very easily make a good ticket where in various combinations you're using 70-80% of the horses in the sequence potentially. I mean, again, it all depends. I'm not saying that's always going to be a good idea, but there are times where that's definitely going to be a good idea. And I think anybody who habitually uses the all button really needs to take a crash course in Ticketmaker ASAP.
Yeah, and I'm glad you guys mentioned Ticketmaker, and I want to jump back to last year's Travers Day card. We did a webinar on Ticketmaker in the late pick 4. And I wanted to refresh your memory. The first leg of that late pick 4 was the King's Bishop. The way I did it, I think I tweeted out my play, which this is partly a what was I thinking and me talking about what I could have done and maybe should have done a little bit differently. But Jonathan, you and I had pretty similar opinions on most of the races, except a very strong disagreement on the King's Bishop. You thought Competitive Edge was the best horse and the most likely winner, and I thought he was a horrible favorite that I was completely going to play my whole ticket around. So we were right, we agreed generally on the other legs, but what I did in that first leg is I used 3 horses as A's and used some semblance of between A's and B's and C's all of the horses in the King's Bishop. I had Run Happy, Loose on the Lead, and Limousine Liberal as my A's, but I had every horse as at least a C in that first leg because I thought it was a wide open race with a vulnerable favorite. So I ended up carrying through my 3 A's and was alive to American Pharoah as well as my C's. I only used American Pharoah as an A and then a few horses as C's. What I could have and should have done was essentially said, if American Pharoah doesn't win the last race, I can buy the race with C's. It would have cost me an extra $2 or something ridiculous like that. And then I would have taken down that pick 4 because for whatever reason I didn't have keen ice. I thought if there was going to be a closer, probably Texas Red was going to be a better play, whatever. But that is where I will often use the all. If I'm right in my other opinions, I'm right in, really right in 3 of my legs, especially knowing that I could beat a favorite in the first leg with a nice price in either Run Happy, Limousine Liberal, or Loose on the Lead, I want to make sure I catch that pick 4 if I'm wrong in one of my other 4.
Right. I think Pete can kind of speak on this a little bit just from our times hanging out and kind of talking about betting strategies. But I'm kind of okay with missing the pick 4. And that's kind of why I've – in the pick 5. I'm okay with missing it from time to time because I would rather than the times where you hit it and kind of just break even or, you know, you invest $400 and you get back $525 or whatever, I would rather I'll just lose those days. And then the days that I'm right, there's the days that I crush them.
Yeah.
And I take their soul. You know what I mean? Like that. So that's kind of like, that's kind of my approach, which is fine. I mean, but it's what your handicapping or gambling appetite it wants. It's what you feel comfortable doing. If you know, some people feel comfortable just kind of grinding it out. I'm too impatient to be that grinder.
Yeah, it definitely depends on what your own personal betting style is. And the other point I'll make is you don't necessarily have to choose between the two extremes. The one extreme being covering possibilities. The other, Jonathan's crushing the soul. You can write a bet that tries to do both of those things. You know what I'm saying? You can take a portion of your bet. This is an idea that I've been talking to Mike Maloney about a lot lately, where I won't use his terms. I'll save the way he describes it for when he's ready to write about it or talk about it. But the idea is you take a certain portion of your bet to cover the possibilities, and you take another portion to knock it out of the ballpark. And it's you know, you can get to a PhD level. I mean, I think Ticketmaker gives the average player a chance to get up to college level bet writing in record time. But you can also go even beyond when you get to the level of a guy like that. You go beyond the mere college level, and you get into doctorate stuff.
Yeah,
and you know, you can use that as your basis, and then continue to be creative and write additional tickets based upon it.
One quick thing I would just suggest trying if you've never done it before. Not, I mean, I know you guys probably have, but when you're doing this, find out which one you're more comfortable with. You can actually open up. I've done it from time to time. I'll open up two Ticketmaker windows, and I'll say my budget's $200. I'll spend like $100 on one ticket and $100 on the other, and I'll make one like very unbelievably aggressive, and then I'll make one a little bit more kind of catch the ticket type, and play both of them. And like Pete said, you're being both of those extremes at one time.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm also with you a little bit. I mean, my budget is considerably smaller than you, Jonathan, and probably you too, Pete. So I'll maybe take a stab at like a $10 or $12 pick four play, where I'm taking a strong stand against a favorite I don't like, and if he beats me, I beat me, you know, because I don't want to spread and increase my budget to catch a horse I don't like that's just going to drag my payout down.
Right.
Well, that's just smart. And there's different attitudes, and this was another conversation I wanted to have. I think we better get to these races, though, as we're running out of time.
Well, we got about half an hour. Yeah, or 25 minutes. Yeah.
He has to come in to do his new live streaming show, so we got to get out of here for him.
We got 20, 25 minutes. I think we'll have plenty of time to cover our four public handicapper races. The first one, of course, is the Tampa Bay Derby, the 11th race at Tampa on Saturday. It's only a few minutes before the first of the four graded stakes races at Santa Anita. So if you're playing them in real time, or if you're putting them in public handicapper and you're waiting until that window an hour before, don't sleep on one, because they'll be coming up quickly. But yeah, the 11th at Tampa Bay, it's the Grade 2 Tampa Bay Derby, 50 points towards the Derby, Kentucky Derby, for the winner. 10 horses entered. Pete, we'll start with you, because you haven't been on for a couple weeks, to give your opinion. Where did you land in the Tampa Bay Derby?
I am going to try to get a little tiny bit clever here, I think, with Tale of Saval.
No,
because you hate, or no, because you love?
No, because I love.
Okay. For me, the case is pretty simple. Showed great promise last year, and I think the sort of instant analysis when I looked at the race was that he'd be up with the pace, but there's so much other speed in here. He's shown the ability to pass horses. Why can't he sit like in the debut race? I think he could get the jump on Brody's Cause, who's going to be, you know, maybe not fully fit, and just the deepest of deep closers, and have a chance to work out a really good trip here and maybe make a little bit of noise at a number.
All right. Well, it sounds like Jonathan agrees to some extent. Jonathan, do you, you know, your thoughts on Tale of Saval? And let me ask you both, what kind of price do you think you'll get?
I'm not a price predictor. I'll take. I mean, I'm sure he'll be 8-1 or higher, and I would imagine, and I'll take it.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay.
How about you guys? You.
Pete.
That sounds about right. 8 sounds reasonable. I certainly wouldn't. I wouldn't sneeze at that. And I think that sounds about right. Jonathan, what do you think of my analysis of the idea of him maybe sitting off the pace? Do you think he'll be up in the vanguard? What kind of trip you think he's going to work out? And what is it you like about the horse?
Well, you know, it's funny. So to answer your question, I'll answer your question in a second. The thing that I fell in love with initially was the idea that Barkley Tag wins 8% with first-time starters, and that horse won at Saratoga pretty darn impressively, like a good thing. I loved the horse in the Champagne, and as we can look down at the PPs, and most of us probably remember, it was sloppy that day. So the horse had an excuse, which I love, which is like a built-in, I can throw that race out. Now it looks like he's been working up a storm. I can't wait to see what Vesci and Welsh have to say about the horse and the workout report. And then to answer your question, in the workout report, I'm going to read how they've been training this horse to determine how I feel like they'll run the horse. If they'll if they've been running, working him in company, and he's been working off of another horse, then I would imagine that's something they'll be doing. If they've been working him alone, maybe they're going to show a little bit more speed. Let's see how. Just kind of read. You can, you know, you can read through those things and really get an idea of how they're training the horse. But if that horse is training forwardly, I mean, I'll use them on every tournament I'm playing in.
All right, I like it. I'm on a similar type of horse, a layoff horse who's shown early speed, and I'm going to be paying particular attention to those workout reports from Welsh and Vessi. I'm talking about number 6, Riker, who I thought ran a much better race than it looks on paper in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. I don't know, 8-1 might be a little high, but I'm guessing 6-1 seems like a fair price for a horse that a lot of people are going to question whether or not dirt is the right surface for. I think it might be. I think he's a good one. He's been seemingly working well for his return to the races, and now in a new barn, in Mark Cassie's barn, he really set things up for Brody's Cause to rally up and get third in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. Brody's Cause was also really pace-aided in the Breeders' Futurity. There might be some speed. Maybe there's enough to set up his rally in the Tampa Bay Derby. But I'm way against him if he goes favorite in this race. And I think it's going to be I like Tale of Spall a little bit too, but I think Riker might just be a little bit better off of that, you know, Breeders' Cup form. But yeah, a lot of it will come to price.
I got a piece of info on him from the Daily Racing Form preview article that quoted Mark Cassie saying something to the effect of, on a scale from 1 to 10, he's been training like a 10. So
nice.
Riker is doing well. I'm a little worried if he's just fast enough / good enough. He's on my radar, certainly. He definitely has an interesting developmental pattern. At the end of the day, I thought you might find a couple of these too difficult, but at a price, certainly not one I would warn anybody off.
And then, I pay attention when Sharp Outfits purchase horses, because I don't think Team Valor owned him when he ran at Keeneland in the Breeders' Cup, right?
I don't believe so. I think that was part of the trainer change.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so I pay attention to those types of things. Barry Irwin and Team Valor, they don't typically buy synthetic horses and switch them over to the dirt. They'll buy those types of horses and keep them on the grass or keep them on the synthetic. So I think that's says a lot about maybe that horse's ability on the dirt.
They do have a good track record of seeming turf and synth horses having success on the dirt. Look no farther than Animal Kingdom for proof
that's
of that
right.
one.
That's right. Well,
maybe that's our teaser for our red boarding the Derby next week. Huh?
Let's do it. One other thing I noted from Formulator, I clicked on the last two works for Riker. Of course, you have to just guess based on the times who he was working in company with. Those work reports from Welsh and Vessi will actually name those horses. But in that last one on March 4th, where he was second of 54, the bullet was Sky Captain, who's a Mark Cassie horse. I'm guessing he was working with Sky Captain, who's a nice older stakes quality horse. And then that bullet work he had on February 27th, he was 3/4 of a second faster than the number 2 of 31 that day, and more than a second faster than the number 3. So based on raw times, he's working pretty quickly. I think there were 4 or 5 Conquest whatever horses, so I'm not sure which one of him he was working with that day, but I got to guess it was one of those. All right, let's jump to Santa Anita. It's the big cap card, a huge day of racing in Southern California. 5 stakes races, 4 of them are graded. The first of the 4 graded stakes races is the 6th race. It's the Grade 1 Kilrow Mile. Only 7 horses entered, but I think you can make a case for probably 6 of the 7 in here. Jonathan, you'll be playing in the Santa Anita contest tomorrow. I'm sure that this race will have a big part of determining, may have a big part of determining who wins that contest. So who are you looking to play in here, and who do you like for public handicapper?
Well, I'll be playing in a tournament. The Santa Anita tournament's not next weekend.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I just can't pack opportunity to hang out with Pete, so I came out for the weekend to
gotcha.
get a little Eddie Logan. But no, it's not till next weekend. But this will be involved in a lot of the. I think this might be a race in the DRF tournament platform this weekend. But I fell in love with What of You this summer, and I think that that's just. I just think he's an absolute racehorse, and. I think we talked about this horse before, but you know Kent kind of had got in trouble this summer or got some negative attention for his ride on that horse, and that, ever since then every ride
Redemption.
On that horse has been like he has been yeah. like magnificent. So
Redemption.
I think we'll have Kent's full yeah for sure. I think we'll have Kent's full attention. I want to dislike Bolo for a lot of reasons, and he ran huge the other day, and so you know depending on price, I would imagine Bolo will probably go off favored. At least I would think so, based on that last performance. But I might be able to catch a little value with What of You. That's probably where I'll look. I'm against a lot of the other ones. I didn't think Ohm had an excuse. I don't like Bali Bali. And the other ones I think are going to be pace problems for each other. And so I'll probably look at What of You.
I'll give you Ohm's excuse. Just coming off that layoff. You don't – I mean, I know.
All right, well – Jonathan doesn't like Bala Bali, but I do, because this is a race where Jonathan mentioned What of You. I think he's going to go. His best races have come on or near the lead. I think Ohm's best races have come on or near the lead. I think Bolo has done some of his better work on or near the lead. Kenji Storm, 50-1 on the morning line, he has to go. There is no way he's hitting the board if he doesn't go. Midnight Storm is forwardly placed. Bala Bali is going to get a good setup. He hasn't really – he's been a little bit closer to the pace in the last couple. I think if you go back, he gets back to the flat mile. I think that's where he does his best work. You go back to some of those races, he sits and he pounces, and he has speed to run at. He's going to be very, very dangerous in here, and I think he might get a little overlooked. As the third or fourth choice out of seven that are very, very contested in this race. So we lost both Pete and Mr. Kinchin. So I will move forward on the next race on the card, the San Felipe, which is the seventh, as producer Mike tries to get them back on the line. It's the Grade 2 San Felipe, a mile and a 16th. For three-year-olds, it's another Kentucky Derby points race. Another race where you have seven entered in the field. It's a small field, but it's a very contentious one. And I kind of wonder what the price is going to be on some of these horses. More Spirit, 2-1 on the morning line. He's famously had an aborted work since that last race in the Robert Lewis. Then he worked seemingly pretty well afterwards. Some question marks in there. He's good. He's probably the class of the race, but I don't know if I like him at a short price. And Jonathan, you're back.
I am.
All right. I started going into the San Felipe because we lost you.
Got it.
And I was saying before while you were gone, I feel like this. If we jump back to the Kilroe Mile, I feel like the Kilroe Mile is a race that's loaded with a bunch of early speed in here.
Yeah, no, I think so too. But you know what's funny is, I've started to get to a point where, if we notice that these guys that are riding for their life and for their money, I think they realize it too. And sometimes when that happens, you know, people start grabbing and whatever. When you don't have horses like obviously who are just like maniacs from the gate. These horses, you know, Kenji Storm, Midnight Storm, they're forward, but they don't like have to be on the lead. And so it's one of those situations in which I think you'll actually get a fair pace, nothing crazy. Obviously it'll be a little bit quicker than if they weren't in here, but,
I think Kenji Storm goes. I think he has to with Maldonado on, ridiculous long shot. I think he has to go. And just try and run them off their feet, because I don't think there's any way Kenji Storm is going to hit the board unless he just tries to open up and hold on for dear life. So I wonder if that's going to change the complexion of the race a bit. You know, Ohm has done his best running on or near the lead. What of You as well. I mean, I see your point. It might not work out that way on paper, but I think that there's going to be some decent speed, and I'm hoping it sets it up for Bala Bali getting back to that flat mile. I think we had a horse last summer who looked like he could be one of the players on the Southern California turf scene. Things kind of went off track a little bit. I think Mandela's been focusing on this race, and from what I hear, he's been working well for the return. And I think he could be a little bit overlooked in the wagering. So that's who I'm picking.
We should move on, but I just want to make the point really fast, if you guys didn't already, that we're expecting there to be some cut in the ground. So I don't know.
Yes.
You know, that probably helps Jonathan's selection, who ran so well last time with a little bit of cut in the ground in the last race at the final table at the NHC. Just want to throw that little factoid out there for folks to pay attention to so you're not surprised.
Yes, I like it. Pete, where did you land before we move on? Where did you land in the Kilroe Mile?
Oh, I like him.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we didn't get your full case on him. I know you were saying you had an excuse last out, but we didn't hear.
Oh, yeah, it was off a long layoff for a trainer whose charges typically improve. Second off layoff, and I think he projects a perfect trip. But we've got about 9 minutes to do these two other good races here, so we should probably move on.
Let's do it. I started talking about the San Felipe and said why I was knocking More Spirit at a short price. So I'll continue on. I think the horse to beat in here is number 7, Exaggerator. I mean, you look at his running lines. He's run behind Nyquist 3 times. If you take those races out, he's 3-for-4 with 1 second, and that was against Brody's Cause and the Breeders' Futurity. I think this is a good horse who is now getting away from the champion 2-year-old that raced 2 back in the Delta Jackpot, had 4 next out winners, including Sonny Ridge, who won a stakes race, Found Money, who won a stakes race, Whitmore, who won an optional claimer and then ran 2nd in the Southwest. I think Exaggerator is a really good horse and maybe a little overlooked because people are going to be focusing on Smoky Image, who's 6-for-6. They're going to be focusing on More Spirit. They're maybe even going to be focusing on Dancing Candy. So I just think Exaggerator is the best horse in the race.
I agree.
Pete?
Depending on the position I'm at or what I'm doing or where I'm at in my life, I'll probably lean on Exaggerator as much as I possibly can. My price play that I'm going to take a look at is I Will Score. I thought that horse ran really good. That race at Santa Anita, the times we were actually there that day, and I mean it was like blazing fast. And Mike kind of did it like kind of easy. He never really panicked when horses came to him. I just think he might be a good horse. Obviously, Mike had to get off of this one. Well, he didn't have to, but he decided to get off of this one for Dancing Candy. But I'll definitely look at I Will Score at a price as one of those kind of sneaky ones that could sneak up and get a piece of it.
I agree about Exaggerator as the most likely winner. Exaggerator is an A for me. My pick on Public Handicapper is going to be Dancing Candy on the hope that the nice developmental pattern continues and maybe he can work out a perfect trip here, hopefully rating a little bit in my view of the race. So I'm going to hopefully get a little bit of a price with Dancing Candy, but in the real world, I won't be getting beat by Exaggerator.
It's interesting you say that. We only have a few more minutes, but I will just say this. I'm not sure they're going to be too different in price. Maybe a point, maybe 3-to-1 versus 4-to-1. But I think Dancing Candy is going to get a lot of attention. So with that, let's move on. The 10th race is the Grade 1 Santa Anita Handicap. It's a $1 million race. It's the big cap. We have 9 entered, the most of any of the graded stakes at Santa Anita on Saturday. But this isn't your daddy's big cap. These are 9. Go ahead, Pete. What were you going to say?
I said I don't even think it's your older brother's big cap.
No, it's not even your older brother's big cap. I mean, you've got FNX, who's coming off the win in the Grade 1 Clark Handicap, the only other horse to have a Grade 1 win on their resume is Hard Aces. And boy, that was in the Gold Cup, and he hasn't hit the board since in 5 starts. So
He was third best in that race as well.
Yes, as you like to say every time, but, you know, that was the one time. Well, I picked him last time too, so it was one of the only times I picked him, so I'm still doing all right with Hard Aces. I'm not picking him here. Jonathan, where are you going in the big cap?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'm not going with FNX. He's just like a typical East Coast grinding type. to think that he's going to come out to the West Coast and like beat these, not that these horses are like world beaters, but I just, at a short price, I'll pass. There's two horses that I think are really interesting. I think it's very interesting that the Reddams bought Donworth. It's not something, they don't buy older horses. They buy babies and then they race them. And so I think that's very interesting. I thought that horse ran actually pretty well first time for Doug O'Neill, last time at in the San Antonio. But I think the biggest handicapping puzzle that has to be figured out here is, why did General A-Rod run so well last time? Was it the blinkers? Was it the slop? Was it, you know, there's all these questions, but he ran really, really well. And so that would be one I'd also be interested in. I'm hopeful that the guys, Vesci and Welsh, will include his workouts in their workout report. They usually will throw in Tampa Bay and other places where there's some stakes runners that are running. So I'm hoping to see how he was working. But I think that I'm going to focus on one of those two. I like Imperative, but I think Imperative's going to be bet down a little bit too much. So I think that my money will probably end up with one of those two.
I'll tell you why General A-Rod ran so well last time. He was running against four horses that weren't very good.
Fair.
So if he's 4-1 or anything close to it, I'd be playing against him. He runs big races when he's facing some weak fields, and he's one that I think disappoints too often and disappoints at short prices against good horses. So I'd be looking to play against him. I'm with you. I'm looking to play against FNX. He's probably the best horse in the race, but he's going to be too short a price. And, you know, first time in Southern California, I want him to prove it to me at a short price. I'm actually taking a shot here with one that's a kind of a friend of the podcast, and Cyrus Alexander. A complete underachiever, has not come close to validating that $1.7 million purchase price. And we mentioned his older brother, Super Saver, a little earlier in the show. He hasn't run anything close to validating what Big Bro has done. But here's one that, you know, has hinted at some ability, is maybe a little bit goofy. Now, and you know, as a four-year-old, maybe can put it together, usually off a weak effort in a graded stakes. Hollendorfer, you know, pulls back a little, tries some class relief. The horse seems to be working a lot more forwardly, seems to be working really well. Hollendorfer not only doesn't pull back into graded stakes, but doubles down and puts him into the big cap. He's one I think is going to be, I don't know if he's good enough to win, but I think he's one that's going to outrun his odds.
Right, and I think that he's one, like you mentioned earlier, like with the opening to this race, is that feels like Jerry Sharp, Hollendorfer. He just threw the horse in here because who else is he really scared of?
Yeah, right, exactly.
I feel like last year on the show, we might have even discussed Cyrus Alexander for a spot like this. But the horse I'm going with is one we talked about extensively on the show after the San Antonio, when we basically said, why are they going to send this Donworth to Dubai? He shaped really nicely for that return. He'd be a big threat in the big cap. I see no reason to get off of that train. I'm picking Donworth here. I think he's going to be bet pretty hard, but I'm just going to try to have him as an A or an A-plus in multis and hope that he gets the job done.
All right, yeah, you know, he can win. He's one I would probably use, but I think he's just going to be too short for me. You know, I certainly wouldn't want to get stupid and play against him. He's probably, you know, close to FNX in terms of likelihood, but I think he's probably going to be 5-2 or 2-1. And in a field like this, I don't want a short price. So, all right, gentlemen, we are...
We're out of time. I was going to say, you just talked about how bad a field it is, so maybe 2-1's a good price on Donworth.
Well, he has to convince me he's a graded stakes horse. He hasn't won a graded stakes, and I don't want 5-2 on one that hasn't won a graded stakes.
It's the case than you made before when you talked about how there weren't any real graded stakes horses in the field.
Yeah, but that's why I'm getting 20-1 on Cyrus Alexander. It's all about price, baby. You got two that are seemingly the same kind of horse, except Donworth is less exposed, and so I think he's gonna get bet a lot more heavily. But we do have to wrap because we've got Mr. Matt Bernier coming to the studio in just a few moments. And be sure and check out the Matt Bernier show if you haven't seen it yet. It's pretty cool. And it's new for DRF. All right, gentlemen. Pleasure as always talking with you. Thanks for sitting through some of the technical difficulties. Good luck this weekend. And Pete, I'll let you take it away.
May you win all your photos.